Hello and welcome back to this podcast with me, Andre Vornik. Sorry if I'm slightly out of breath. It's just that I've been running in the Caffarella Valley. This is a huge nature park which extends out from southern Rome, not far from FAO's headquarters, in fact. I'm technically in the city, but I might as well not be, because this is a place full of grassy meadows and clumps of forest, Roman ruins too, and even some small family farms that are making the most of the volcanic soil here, which is rich in mineral salts. There's even a wandering flock of sheep. Oh, actually, I think I just stepped in something. And once in a while, you even catch the shepherd, guiding them with a stick like in old times. All this to say that industrial society, with its mass-produced food and its supermarkets and its consumption modes, all of that seems very remote here. But of course it's not. In the first episode of this podcast, we saw how the response to the widespread hunger and deprivation caused by the Second World War was to crank up agricultural production with machinery and fertilizers and pesticides. And hunger did diminish drastically overall. The global calorie intake expanded, and no doubt countless lives were saved or secured. But it wasn't cost-free.
My name is Andrew Watson. I am an assistant professor in the Department of History at the University of Saskatchewan. I'm an environmental historian, and my particular interest is in the relationship between agriculture, energy, and sustainability. And for a lot of my research, I use a methodology known as social metabolism, which explores the flow of energy and material through agroecosystems as a way of studying how agriculture has changed over time.
In the race to feed the world after 1945, in that rush for production and productivity, what did we lose?
Well, even before the Second World War, fossil fuels were starting to show up in North American agriculture in really important ways by essentially replacing labor. So the need to extensivize agriculture, especially in the American West, meant the widespread adoption of tractors and trucks. In Western Europe, most of industrialization happens after World War II, but everywhere after World War II sees an enormous increase in the application of synthetic fertilizers, which require enormous inputs of fossil fuel energy to produce. But also things like pesticides also require enormous fossil fuel inputs. And then you see on a very wide scale the adoption of irrigation technologies in order to provide a sort of a consistent application of fresh water for agriculture, which will also require a lot of fossil fuel energy.
Our Mrs. Martin just today has already used some 87 petroleum products, including the plastic bacon wrapper and the wax of the milk carton. Mrs. Martin is the customer, and the customer is the boss of the oil industry.
By focusing on all the things we've gained, we end up telling a story of progress, right? That everything kept getting better over time. We kept being able to produce more food and so forth. But some of the great consequences of industrialized agriculture are things like the loss to biodiversity, things like fertilizers ended up creating a variety of point source problems where runoff would cause eutrophication in freshwater bodies. The amount of hormones being used in raising livestock resulted in a variety of these similar kinds of consequences for the non-human nature that wasn't necessarily the target of increased productivity and yields.
And so gradually, people begin to turn around and say, hang on, this is not how it should be. And the environmental factor begins to come into the way the world thinks about agriculture and food production.
Absolutely. I mean, we need to remember that the story after World War II of increased production and all the application of these inputs, including energy, this is largely informed by, a generation or two of living through scarcity. this really shaped the way people thought about their relationship to abundance and food availability. And after World War II, there's this new promise, right? There's peacetime conditions allow for an economic boom, both in Western Europe and North America. The mentality shifts quite significantly, so that people are no longer thinking about needing to live within limits and are increasingly seeing the world as a set of abundant resources that, if slotted into the economic world system, could consistently meet people's needs.
We love to serve you well. Good taste in food, that rings the bell. We take your needs to heart. Your Safeway Supermart. We bring the field fresh harvest across. To you.
But what happens is that starting in the 1960s, and thinking about the impact of mutual assured destruction or nuclear fallout gets people realizing the scale of the impact that people can have. And then something like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which is perhaps the seminal text that sparks the environmental movement, gets people questioning the very values inherent in industrial agriculture and the consequences that result.
These people, apparently the balance of nature was something that was repealed as soon as man came on the scene. Well, you might just as well assume that you could repeal the law of gravity.
The voice of biologist Rachel Carson, who took the American chemical and agricultural establishment to task over toxic pesticides. Her passionate essay, Silent Spring, was published in 1962. The title refers to a land that pesticides have stripped of birdsong. Carson died just 2 years later, but the text went on to influence minds and policy. The chemical compound DDT was banned in the United States in 1972.
The world has heard much of the triumphant war against disease through the control of insect vectors of infection, but it has heard little of the other side of the story, the defeats, the short-lived triumphs that now strongly support the alarming view that the insect enemy has been made actually stronger by our efforts. Even worse, we may have destroyed our very means of fighting.
Andrew, looking back at that quarter century or so after the Second World War, I'm going to try and engage you in a little counterfactual history. Do you think it could have been done any other way?
The tricky thing is that there was a context in the post-war period in which people felt that it was absolutely vital to increase productivity. Thinking just about the Cold War, farmers in the United States were engaged in industrializing their farm systems at the same time as the Soviet Union was engaged in industrializing their farm systems. So even just within the context of the Cold War tensions, you can imagine the resistance that there would have been for a lot of state, Western state governments to try some other alternative when the Soviet Union was engaged in such a massive expansion in agricultural productivity.
You make it sound almost like the race for the moon, for the control of space.
Absolutely. There's almost a scene like that. If there isn't that kind of investment in industrialized agriculture, then that becomes a sort of a national risk.
There has indeed been a geostrategic element to the way agriculture has evolved. And by 1989, when the Berlin Wall falls, there's a new upsurge in international cooperation to tackle some of humanity's most entrenched problems. For FAO, this is the great era of plant protection, of safeguarding fish stocks, of combating animal diseases. The pursuit of food security becomes embedded in a broader move to nourish life on Earth and manage natural resources responsibly. Innovation picks up. When it comes to fighting plagues of locusts, for instance, FAO's methods begin to change.
This biopesticide is formulated using the spores of a fungus, which is specific to locusts and grasshoppers. When the spores come into contact with a locust, they germinate and penetrate its cuticle. At that point, the fungus develops inside the body until it kills the insect.
But one thing that proves much harder to shift over the years is the uneven way the agricultural cookie crumbles. The pile of calories generated in the rich parts of the world tends to stay there. Regions of Asia, untouched by the Green Revolution, sections of South America, and much of Africa remain hungry. Here's Julius Nyerere, the Tanzanian leader,
speaking at an FAO conference back in the 1970s.
Mr. President, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, the United Nations World Food Congress made obvious the urgent matter of human hunger in an era of increasing prosperity. Our nations have not found the answer to absolute rural poverty. If poverty is to be abolished in the rural areas, farming activities have to be efficient. Rural industries must be established to process the farmers' crops and provide many of the domestic and agricultural goods.
Nyerere's words reflect how perceptions had altered from the time of FAO's foundation. The world's food architecture was a more complex thing than it first seemed. Lizzie Collingham, you may recall, is someone we heard in the first episode of this podcast describing the hunger landscape of Victory Day. She says the early notion that once it was produced in quantities, food would naturally spread around the world to fill the gaps didn't quite pan out in the long term. And that, despite the generous vision of John Boyd Orr, the first Director General of FAO, and of the other 1945 internationalists.
During the Second World War, the Combined Food Board was the allied organisation which looked at which countries were producing which foods, how they could be got from one place to another, deficit areas from growing areas and so on. It was fractious, but they did actually manage to cooperate very, very well. And the Combined Food Board was seen as a success. Boyd Orr's idea was that we should have a World Food Board and that this would encourage people to grow more of these nutritious foods because they would be able to sell them to the people who needed them. This wonderful, rather utopian vision doesn't come to anything, but that is the vision that was born out of the Second World War.
Well, it did to some extent because production increased tremendously over the next 20 years or so and almost uninterruptedly, I believe, until 1970 or thereabouts. But in a sense, today we have a much more complex understanding than this kind of, as you say, utopian, certainly idealistic warehouse management type of conception.
Yeah, I suppose. And I guess one side of the vision was realised. I mean, Europe switched back from being a net importer of wheat to being an exporter of wheat after the Second World War. But there's always been enough food to feed everybody in the world, but it's how to distribute that food equitably and in such a way that, you know, people who grow it get enough profit. And yes, it's too utopian and simplistic to say, oh, well, let's stockpile it and just sell it to the people who need it. That was a naive view of it, I suppose.
In the event, such were the crises, natural or man-made, that shook the world in the second half of the 20th century, that much of the food that wasn't traded ended up given away.
I think in the post-war era, you had some countries where agriculture was making huge strides and surpluses were being produced, but other areas which were really, really struggling.
Jane Howard is a former journalist who speaks for the World Food Programme, a body set up by FAO and the United Nations with American encouragement in the early 1960s to get food relief to people in global emergencies. Earlier this year, the World Food Programme was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
President Eisenhower was somebody who suggested that maybe we should just give it a try, a three-year experiment to set up an organisation just really as a food aid programme, but with quite a bit of money they put behind it to redistribute commodities and cash to help people get through that very difficult period.
And all these years later, it's the largest humanitarian organisation in the world.
Well, that's right, because very soon it was seen that there were emergencies in the world, there wasn't a UN mechanism, and within months the World Food Programme responded to an earthquake in Iran. They gave out tea, they gave out cube sugar, as well as rice and lentil, things like that, somehow stabilising the situation. And since then, there were natural disasters, there were floods, the earthquakes that lead to people fleeing their homes and becoming dependent on food assistance.
But also, I believe that food aid or food assistance these days has moved on a great deal, and a lot of the time it's no longer about handing out tea, lentils, sugar, any of these things, really.
Increasingly, these days, you might get a text message on your phone and a bank account is topped up, or you may be able to go to a shop in deepest Somalia and spend the cash credited to your mobile phone. In one part of Jordan, in some of the big refugee camps there for Syrian refugees, There are places where you go into the camp shop and you can pay with an iris scan.
And of course, while the economy of food assistance has changed a lot, one thing hasn't, and that's war.
I think, if anything, what we've seen is perhaps it's post-Cold War, that there are continuing conflicts, but they are conflicts that are lasting longer and longer, because many of them are civil wars. Many of them are not being sorted out by great powers. Right now, if you look at where the World Food Programme is working, 60% of our work is actually in countries that are hit by conflict. And you know, when the World Food Programme was made a laureate of the Nobel Peace Prize, the citation made it clear, you know, that there can be no end to hunger without peace. And I think that it has been very hard for those of us who work on food assistance to accept. After seeing the numbers of hungry people in the world declining year upon year after year, we seem to be making progress, and now that's gone into reverse. And that's partly to do with the impact of climate change, but it's a lot of it is to do with conflict, which is really the big driver of hunger in the world today.
FAO's founding fathers back in 1945 thought never again. Never again would there be such bloodshed that it would interfere with the noble enterprise of feeding humanity. But bloodshed there was, and there is. And so, working to mandate to deliver the world from hunger is no longer about pressing one lever, the one that increases production, but rather all levers at once: political, economic, technological, and environmental. In the next and final episode, we'll be looking at some of the ways we might still get there, and asking whether we still need the land to feed the world.